So I'm taking on something slightly ambitious. I wrote this paper during my undergrad for a philosophy of law class, and I made the argument that pornography violated a woman's positive liberty, a term that I'm going to explain in a bit. And, I mean, it's not a very, you know, it's not an original thesis at all. It was literally, the question of the paper was, does pornography violate a woman's positive liberty? But, you know, I had a lot of fun actually writing that paper. It was very interesting dealing with those legal arguments, and it really exposed me to a lot of legal philosophical literature. And over the past few years, I wrote that paper when I was in my second year of undergrad, and now in my final semester of my master's. But over the years since, I've written a lot about the pervasiveness of a particular pornographic culture, mainstream popular culture, and the effects that this has on our understanding here in North America of on sexuality. And so what I'm going to try to do today is show how a pornographic culture leads to the violation of Muslim women's, particularly those Muslim women who veil, and the veil defined in terms of the hijab, which is what I'm wearing, or even the niqab, and to another extent, the burqa. But primarily I'm going to deal with the hijab and then I guess the niqab, because it is relevant to us now more so than ever. And I'm going to argue how it violates positive and, in a way, also our negative liberty, because the debate regarding, the philosophical debate regarding pornography revolves around the issue of free speech, which is a negative liberty. And I'm going to argue that it actually, whichever perspective we take, we can find that even negative liberty is compromised. And that it strips women of their agency. And I know if it sounds weird or confusing, just bear with me as I go through this. First, let's define our terms. For the sake of brevity, I'm just going to go through the terms. I mean, these are major philosophical concepts, so I'm just going to give very basic overviews. So the concepts of liberty. There are many concepts of liberty, but there are two very popular ones, which were popularized, but certainly not initiated by Isaiah Berlin in his work, Two Concepts of Liberty. And he was a libertarian thinker. There's positive liberty, which is the freedom to pursue and achieve willed goals and also have the autonomy or self-rule as opposed to dependence on others. The way that positive liberty, we would understand it, it's essentially, the best example would be a sort of like social contract, right? So Jean-Jacques Rousseau is kind of often critiqued by Berlin for his idea of the general will, which is an idea that sometimes we, when we enter into society, we allow certain restrictions on our freedoms in an attempt to be more free. So it's that idea, restrictions on our freedoms in an attempt that everyone can be freer. Which, of course, Berlin had a problem with, because that led to, he believed that could ultimately lead to an authoritarian society. So there's positive liberty. There's negative liberty, the freedom from not being obstructed by others and doing whatever one may wish to do, which is generally in line with the libertarian philosophy, and that's is the idea, for instance, of speech, which is the most commonly cited negative liberty, that nothing should ever come in the way of restricting, in any sense of the word, one's freedom of speech. So, what about pornography? That's also a fun term to define. And if you, again, if you look at the literature, it really differs. And there's a very famous quote that probably everyone's aware of, which is by Justice Stewart from 1964, that I can't define pornography, I just know it when I see it. It's great, except we need something more tangible to work with if we're going to be talking about the effects of pornography on this presentation. So we need to work on a particular definition that's broad but still uncompromising of the particular nature of pornography. So what I'm working with is that it's sexual explicitness at the most basic, and beyond that, it's the representation of the perpetuation of existing gendered power dynamics and the commoditization of sexual explicitness for an economic gain, which is also the definition where we have some of the individuals I'll be using are also kind of working within this framework. So let's talk about then treading on women's positive liberty. Catherine MacKinnon, many of you may be familiar with her, many of you may not be. She's a very famous feminist and also a law professor. I believe she's at the University of Ann Arbor, I can't remember. But she sees pornography as an issue which has provided the setting for a definitive development of absolutist approach to speech. It is in her opinion that as soon as pornography becomes pervasive, speech will be defined so that men can have their pornography, as American obscenity law merely illustrates one adaptation of this principle. Some men ineffectually prohibit it, while others vaunt it openly as a standard of speech as such. So what she was discussing here was that pornography has now ultimately just become, in particular in American society, the standard of speech. So what we are, when we talk about, freedom of speech, it's ultimately sometimes boils down to the issue of pornography. Does it violate the pornographer's freedom of speech if we are restricting it or censoring it or anything? McKinnon sees a severe patriarchal bias within the law and believes that it's creating more harm than healing, i.e. that pornography law was not created to examine the harm which is done to women. The advancement of methods of distribution of sexually explicit materials has only worsened the problem, as it has allowed for pornography to become more widespread, making the abuse of women more and more invisible as abuse, as that abuse becomes more and more visible as sex. This has led to the inability of the judicial system to determine what pornography is and what it isn't, according to McKinnon. She further points out that there's a substantial double standard within the law in regard to how general pornography and child pornography are perceived, with the latter being viewed as something immensely harmful and not considered the speech of a sexually dissident minority, which it is, and it advocates certain ideas about children and sex, which it does. While general pornography is seen as being the exact opposite, as a means of expression for an outcast dissenters. By equating pornography with the freedom of speech, women become ideas and the abuse of their sexuality becomes a discussion which is protected under the Constitution. Along with pornography, parallel she makes between, very famous parallel she makes between, it was her and also Andrew Dworkin, between pornography and the Nazis. And what she basically says is that women's reactions to the presentation of other women being sexually abused in pornography and the reaction of Jews to having Nazis march to their town are routinely degraded as being mere issues of offensiveness rather than an actual inequality-inducing act, which causes deep psychological harm to those who are directly attacked by them. So, now again, she's working on this idea of positive liberty, which I'm going to get into more when I discuss Charles Taylor. And why she's talking about the importance of looking at psychological harm when we talk about issues of free speech and beyond. So Ronald Dworkin, who is the savior and defender of pornographers everywhere, finds McKinnon's arguments ridiculous. He says there's no evidence to directly link pornography and sexual violence. So to say that the ability of women meaning that their freedom to actualize their potential is compromised by pornography is imaginative. And a call for censorship and a restriction works to obstruct the pornographer's freedom of speech, which is a negative liberty. Plus, what about negative imagery elsewhere? It's a stereotype to perpetuate by everyday images via advertisements and television shows. This eclipses the effects of sadistic pornography, which is nowhere near the same circulation level. Dworkin argues that even if a causal relationship was shown and that the economic inequality, because he's talking about the debate at the time, which was looking at the economic inequality that's caused by pornography in the workplace where women receive sexual harassment, not getting hired as often as men, etc., that the economic inequality can be partially attributed to pornography, it would plainly be unconstitutional to ban speech directly advocating that women occupy inferior roles or none at all in commerce and the professions, even if that speech fell on willing male ears and achieved its goals. He agrees that for the Constitution to promote prohibition of official censorship while protecting the right of private citizens physically to prevent other citizens from publishing or broadcasting specified ideas would be contradictory, as it would allow private citizens to violate the negative liberty of other citizens by preventing them from saying what they wish. But there's no contradiction exists in allowing every idea to be expressed and heard, even if they entail negative consequences. He asserts an idea promotes, even if an idea promotes something that's misconstruing or degrading or silencing or whatever, it doesn't matter, even if it's a bad consequence, because it comes down to, and he quotes Asaiah Berlin from a lecture, that everything is what it is. Liberty is liberty. It's not equality. It's not fairness. It's not justice or culture or human happiness or a quiet conscience. It's just, so what now? I want to bring in Charles Taylor, whose critique of negative liberty I think is probably one of the most poignant ones. And what he says is that negative liberty relies on either the opportunity concept or the exercise concept, and it doesn't take into account internal obstacles that arise, and that can be a huge deterrent to our ability to actualize our potential or to, be free. For instance, if a student in medical school develops an addiction to speed while he or she used it so that he or she could become more studious and productive, that addiction can become an obstacle to that student's goal of becoming a surgeon or physician or whatever he or she may want to be. Negative liberty, however, only concerns itself with something. It doesn't take into account. Another thing Taylor also brings to light is that when we practice our freedoms, we discriminate in our freedoms. I mean, we, even though ultimately freedoms are should be in and of themselves equal, we know in practice that they're not. I mean, for instance, he brings the example of Albania and the UK. He's like, in Albania, religion has been abolished, but there are fewer traffic lights, meaning less restriction of mobility. But there, you know, there's not a practice of faith is not valued. Whereas in the UK, let's say you have a lot more traffic lights, but a lot fewer, a lot more traffic lights, but you have freedom to practice whatever religion you want. So which is a freer society? He's like, that is a clear indication that we would put a particular, I mean, obviously we would say, oh yeah, the religious society, or the society that allows for religion to be practiced, because we realize the integral nature of religion and culture and whatnot to an individual's identity coming from our liberal democratic background. So what happens when we take pornography outside its cloaked industry and away from private screens and bring it into our mainstream? In her 2005 book, Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture, sorry, my voice. Ariel Levy looks at precisely that. She looks at this emergence, this new emergence in feminism, in female sexuality, in which women have appropriated patriarchal and oppressive forms of sexual oppression and made them into a falsified exploration of self-liberation. Levy looks at the meaning of sexy and how it's become something resonant in images and actions of a pornographic culture. She looks at young girls, men, and the effects of these things, even on lesbian culture, and she spares really no one. We know that there's hypersexualization of our mainstream pop culture. We know this. We can see it in popular music videos, popular songs, images, lyrics, which have been, you know, all these things that we previously kind of had been on the fringe and labeled as pornographic are now becoming the norm. And we know this is having an effect on us as well. There was a 2007 report by the American Psychological Association which looked at the sexualization of girls and the effect this is and can have on them. It stated that, quote, ample evidence testing these theories indicates that sexualization has negative effects on in a variety of domains, including cognitive functioning, physical and mental health, sexuality, and attitudes and beliefs. In other words, we know that there is a potential at minimum for considerable creation of internal obstacles for women, young girls, related to their self-esteem and development. So, but what does this mean then for veiled Muslim women? What I'm arguing is that the mainstreamization of pornographic sexuality as an increasingly dominant representation of sexuality infringes on veiled Muslim women's positive liberty, in particular, by stripping them of their agency. They experience discrimination and internal obstacles as any other women in our society do. But with the added burden of the mainstream media representation of Islam and popular understanding of sexuality. In other words, Muslim women who veil are not only rid of their agency in their choice to wear what they want to wear and choose to live their life as they wish, but they are further stripped of their sexual agency. They are repressed and can't choose their clothes. And both of these ideas are based on not only on the popular characterization of Islam and Muslims, but also on how we interact with sexuality. And this is dangerous because it doesn't recognize the veil as an expression of sexuality, which it is. And it also really narrows down our understanding of sexuality. But what I would further argue is that whichever perspective you look at it from in terms of liberty, we can make an argument that liberty is completely violated. A veiled Muslim woman's positive liberty, their freedom too, is compromised, yet so is their negative liberty if that's the perspective we wish to take. Freedom from any obstruction to freedom is compromised. Discrimination and stripping of any and all agency is an obstruction of a woman's freedom to live her life as she pleases because her ability and her body are being dictated and controlled by those beyond her, and those with great force, apparently, and apparently with greater freedom, that it renders her within certain parameters that she's almost unable to escape. Restrictions to freedom need not come from only the law and the state, which is what a lot of supporters of negative liberty will argue. Social institutions and industries, corporations, so on and so forth, are more than capable of creating equally debilitating restrictions.